call Senate Resources to order. The time is 2:48. We have Ms. Wendy King with us today. Senate Bill 104 from ConocoPhillips. We're joined today with Senator Wagner, Senator McGuire, Senator Green, Huggins, excused, our Stedman and Stevens. And in addition, we have the chairman of House Special Committee on Oil and Gas, Representative Vic Coring from Wasilla. Coming in the door, munching on goodies, is Ralph Samuels of the House Special Oil Committee. And Senator Wilikowski is joining us. Wendy, if you'd put yourself on the record, we are here.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Wendy King. I'm the Director of State Negotiations for ConocoPhillips. I work for ConocoPhillips at Anchorage, and I've been working on the ANS gas development project for 4.5 years. I'm pleased to be here today to testify on Senate Bill 104 for the proposed AGIA bill. And I'd highlight, I think there's some handouts or some presentation materials, and rather than work off the screen, we're going to work off the handout. I'll try to do my best to try to follow you through, even though there's not slide numbers on here. I'll try to do my best to draw your attention to the different points in the slides. Before I discuss the bill, and we'll turn to that first slide labeled Investing in Alaska Today, I want to reintroduce to the committee ConocoPhillips and what our business in Alaska looks like. ConocoPhillips is the state's largest oil and gas producer. We have had 1,200 uninterrupted LNG shipments since 1969 from the Kenai LNG plant. We are the state's largest acreage holder on the ANS, and we have drilled over 60 exploration wells since 1999. We have drilled 16 wells in NPRA, where we're the operator. ConocoPhillips, I get to learn new little facts about my company all the time, but one of them was that ConocoPhillips heritage company, Phillips, was the first oil company to establish an office in Alaska. Just to move on, just in general comments, I wanted to emphasize that timing on this project is important. We would agree with the administration that the timing is an important issue. Our company is committed to developing the ANS gas resources, and ConocoPhillips is willing to consider creative solutions. We are eager to find a framework by which both parts of the project, both the midstream and the resource parts of the project, can be advanced. And I want to step back for a second and define that. The midstream sides of the project, and I'm going to use that term quite a bit, for me, it involves what we call the gas transmission lines, the gas treatment plant, the big pipe that would go to Alberta, and then what the different alternatives might be from Alberta to markets in the lower 48. So all components of that I would call the midstream portions of the project. The upstream or the resource portions of the project or the assets that would be asked to be making shipping commitments to the project. So assets like the working interest owners in Prudhoe Bay or NPRA or other exploration. So it's more from the perspective of a resource owner, working interest owner. That's those kind of the terminology I'll use. The next slide in your pack is what makes the Alaska project different. And what you've got here is a graph of the North American gas pipeline projects that have happened since 1997 that are greater than $100 million. And I think from a visual perspective, I think the first thing our eyes always go to when we look at this graph is that the cost of the Alaska gas pipeline project is just off the scale. I mean, this has got the $20 billion 2001 estimate on it. But you can see, you know, here's the Rockies Express project, a pipeline project that's in construction right now. Its estimated cost for a 1,300-mile pipeline is $4 billion. The Alliance project, which was completed in December of 2000, it's a 1.3 BCF a day pipeline, cost around $3.6 billion, and it's an 1,800-mile pipeline. MacDelta, I'm sure most of you have read the Mackenzie Delta project, the cost increases that have just occurred on Mackenzie Delta project. I believe the public estimate that was just made on that is $14 billion, including the upstream developments. That's U.S. dollars. And that's a 1.2 BCF a day project. So I just flag, you know, the Alaska Gas Pipeline project being a 3,600-mile pipeline with a cost estimate greater than $20 billion is just not comparative to these. It's much bigger. The scale is significantly larger. And I would also highlight that comparing, you know, you can't just take and say it's a $30 billion project or a $20 billion project, whatever the number ends up being, and say that's 10 times $2 billion projects. The scale is just different. You can't just multiply it up. The next point I wanted to make was on... Oh. Yeah.
Wendy, if you would, Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Since the cost is so much for this. How many miles did you say it was? 30?
Senator Willikowski, through the chair, it's 3,600 miles from Alaska's North Slope to Chicago, which would be one of the markets in the lower 48.
Since that is 3,600 miles, doesn't it make sense to start maybe thinking a little bit more about building a simply 800-mile line down to Valdez and shipping it by LNG?
Senator Willikowski, through the chair, actually that is a question that ConocoPhillips, being the current operator and have had an existing LNG operation in Alaska for decades, it's a question we consistently look at. And we still believe, with the cost, you'd still have to build an 800-mile pipeline, you still have to have the gasification, tankers, move it to a market and get it to it. And a disadvantaged market in the context of you can only access the coast and have to bring in. We still believe the total costs are better going with a pipeline project through Canada to the lower 48. So we've looked at it. We continually look at it. We think we bring a unique perspective on that. We have proprietary technology on LNG, and we still believe the cost is better to go with a pipeline project to markets in the lower 48 through Canada. The next slide, if you turn to, and you know, this is, you know, predicting natural gas prices, it's a risky business. And this graph is actually just to highlight a quick critical point here. What you've got on here is the forward curve that was published on December 9th, 2005. That's the black line on this graph. And what underneath it is what the actual gas prices were over the course of that year. So for me, I find this quite a staggering graph in that it kind of grounds me that we can't even predict natural gas prices within a one-year time frame. Can you imagine trying to do that for a 30 or 40-year time frame? And that's the one of the key risks that the resource owners bear in this project, is that the volatility and the uncertainty on natural gas prices. I'd like to also highlight that ConocoPhillips wants to work with the Alaska Legislature and Governor Palin on a framework that will advance a project. We agree a public, transparent process is needed, and we also believe a balanced deal is needed to stand the test of time. The project is just too big to have a winner-loser mentality. We've got to find a balanced deal to go forward. We believe ConocoPhillips can bring a lot of value to this project. We have financial strength. We have Arctic experience. We have Alaska experience. We operate in Alaska. We have project management skills, and we have mega project skills. And we have key learnings from other pipeline projects that we're involved in. We also believe we bring a unique perspective to this, and that we are an existing producer, but we are also an explorer. We have a track record of trying to advance the Alaska Gas Pipeline project, and we have spent millions of dollars trying to do that. My primary focus today is to convey that we want to work in a constructive way with you to move forward, but more work is needed. The first time ConocoPhillips saw the bill, proposed bill, was on March 2nd, which was the first day it was released to the public. We have had our teams reviewing the bill and are eager to find a framework that will allow development of ANS gas resources to advance. We need to be able to work through some critical issues with the Alaska Legislature and Governor Palin. We are not locked into the old proposal, but we need to find a framework that addresses the critical resource issues that are needed to support long-term shipping commitments for this project. One aspect of the proposed bill that we have noted in particular is the distinction between the midstream and the resource terms. The risk-reward balance is very different between the regulated return portions of the project, particularly when they're backed by strong firm transportation agreements. Just to remind people, firm transportation agreements are those agreements where a shipper would be asked to pay a pipeline what's called a demand charge, day in, day out. And for a project of this magnitude, it could be 20 to 25 years that people are asked to sign that shipping commitment for. And I'd point out as well, you pay for that charge regardless if you ship gas or not. The split between the midstream and the resource, we think, will help to illustrate the differences on risk and reward within the project. That being said, the project will only be successful if both the midstream and the resource risks are addressed. Based on our initial review of the bill, ConocoPhillips has four key question areas that we'd like to discuss with you. We have some suggestions on some of these, but we still don't have solutions for all of these. The four key areas are, first, exclusivity, or what we would call creating roadblocks to alternative projects. The second one is the resource terms themselves. The third one, Will Bucket, is called the midstream bid requirements. And the fourth one is the expansion terms. And I'll go into more detail now on these four areas. Exclusivity, or roadblocks to competing projects. I'd first like to flag, you know, a key question for me. Why would the state want to block alternative projects instead of letting the free market work most efficiently? And I want to draw your attention to Section 440 in the bill.
I'm sorry, Wendy, would you say which section again?
Yes, 43, Chairman Huggins, Section 4390440. This particular section reads, except as otherwise provided in this chapter, the state grants the licensee assurances that the licensee has exclusive enjoyment of the inducements provided under this chapter.
Yeah, hold on just a second.
I'll give you a few minutes, yeah.
Still flipping. Okay, page 18. Okay, line 22. We're now prepared.
Sorry, Chairman Huggins. I was reading from line 22, and I'll read that again. Except as otherwise provided in this chapter, the state grants a licensee assurances that the licensee has exclusive enjoyment of the inducements provided. The licensee has exclusive inducements. Can't read today.
Enjoyment.
Apologies. it's been a long week. I apologize. Start over again. Except as otherwise provided in this chapter, the state grants a licensee assurances that the licensee has exclusive enjoyment of the inducements provided under this chapter. If the state extends to another person preferential royalty, tax, or monetary treatment for the purpose of facilitating the construction of a competing natural gas pipeline project in the state, and if the licensee is in compliance with the requirements of the license and with the requirements of state and federal statutes and regulations relevant to the project, the licensee is entitled to payment from the state of an amount equal to 3 times the total of reasonable cost the licensee has incurred to developing the license project as of that date, that the state first extended preferential treatment to another person. Then I'd like to draw your attention to sections 340 in the bill, and I'll try to find the pages here for you. Actually, sections 330 and 340. I'm particularly looking at what the inducements are on pages 16 and 17 in the bill. And ask a few questions here. The midstream inducements include streamlined coordination for the project. Why wouldn't the state offer the benefits of streamlined coordination to any project? That is how the federal process is set up. The inducements, and particularly in section 340B, line 7, indicate that the inducements, you cannot put burdens, and I recognize that's a word I'm using, but you can read your own words there, on a permit by any state agency would only apply to the licensed project. Does that then mean that the state would be willing to put burdens on a competing or alternative project through the permitting process? The way the bill is currently conceived, it would, from a practical perspective, make it incredibly difficult to permit an alternative project with the state for potentially as long as 10 years. It is not clear that the state could ever provide streamlined permitting to any other project without creating litigation exposure to the original licensee. The exclusive inducements also include the benefits of a state-funded training program for Alaskans. Why would the state be willing to train Alaskans for only one project, the licensed project? Shouldn't qualified Alaskans have the opportunity to be trained and work on any project that is being advanced? By mixing streamlined permitting, the Office of the State Coordinator, Geo-Coordinator, training for Alaskans, and I'll discuss more later on this, creating obstacles to work with resource owners except with regard to the licensed project with the exclusive inducements of a GEA, it becomes difficult to see.
Wendy, excuse me, could you give us a page and a location, which line you're on?
I'm skipped ahead in the bill, but I'm back on 440, and I'm kind of closing in this section here.
Okay, when we do that, if you would just give us a page and a line number,
okay,
it would
help us. Okay, I apologize, Chairman Huggins. Section 440 again, and I'm going to draw on here.
Page.
So page 18, line 22 through 31 again. I'm back to the reference to the exclusive inducements and also the treble damages clause. The exclusive inducements, they include the benefits of a streamlined permitting that's listed in the bill, the office of the AGEA coordinator, the state coordinator, training for Alaskans, and creating obstacles to work with resource owners except with regard to the licensed project. It becomes difficult to see how an alternative project could be advanced any time over the next 10 years unless the licensee agrees that the project is uneconomic, or if there was an arbitrator's award saying that it was uneconomic, that was not challenged by the licensee. I want to emphasize, ConocoPhillips is a supporter of streamlined permitting. We worked very hard on the federal legislation that was passed with the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act. If the state is going to pass similar provisions, we believe they should be available to any project that is being advanced. We request that these sections be amended to make it clear that other projects can advance. So that's particularly the focus in those sections of 440 on page 18, and I'll go back on pages 16 and 17 to the inducements associated with the Alaska Gasland Inducement Act Coordinator. So that's our first area of...
Yes, question for Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Wendy, on that point, so you know the theory behind these inducements, if you will, and the exclusivity of them is to get the project going, to incentivize people who have been similarly situated over the last two decades, depending on how you argue it, and yet nothing seems to be moving forward. So would your argument be that these incentives aren't needed? Or what, I guess what I'm trying to, and I don't disagree, by the way, I'm very concerned about the treble damages associated with that section, because I think a lot of those inducements are things we'd like to offer to anybody that's willing to develop resource development projects in Alaska. But I guess my question is, do you think these inducements are needed in the exclusivity, and if not, what's the alternative?
Senator McGuire, through the chair, I do believe there are value in these inducements. I believe that streamlined permitting, I believe that the state helping with the training program, labor is clearly going to be a challenge for this project. So I do believe that there are value in these inducements. My concern stems, again, the exclusive nature of the inducements. So I do believe, and I understand your concern of wanting to motivate a gas pipeline project going forward. And I believe ConocoPhillips' record since 2000 clearly demonstrates our commitment to try to move this project forward. We are doing what we can to do that. But we see that these inducements should be out there for any project, and if the state takes the chance of tying up those inducements, which would be normal, permitting a project is a normal sovereign power the state would have. If you grant those exclusively, we could see ourselves, if you've chosen the wrong winner, for some reason, the state's chosen the wrong winner, being delayed for a decade, with those inducements being tied up to that licensee. So that's where our concern stems. I do believe there's value in some of these inducements, particularly those around streamlined permitting and those around getting Alaskans ready for the jobs. We would prefer to see those apply to any project that's being advanced and let the market choose which project goes forward. The next area that I wanted to talk about is the resource package. And once again, I want to draw our attention to what do I mean when I say the resource. The resource, once again, is getting the owners, the leaseholders, explorers, whoever else that might want to show up for an open season, those that would be asked to make the shipping commitments to the project and the issues that they face that are unique in being asked to make that shipping commitment. As we stated last month in Senate Resources, the resource risks have always posed the greatest obstacle to a gas pipeline. The predominant resource risk that we want to continue to focus on with the state is in obtaining clarity on the state taxes and royalties that are needed in order to secure long-term shipping commitments. Addressing these issues remains a critical component to make this pipeline a reality. ConocoPhillips appreciates the recognition of the importance of resource issues for a proposed gas line project. Sections 300 through 320 in the bill.
Give us your page number and line.
I'm looking them up right now.
Actually, 14 through.
Did I get to that?
300.
Page 14, Chairman Huggins. Page 14 is the qualifications for resource inducement. 310 is the royalty inducements.
Line 7.
Actually, I'm moving all the way through pages 14 through 16 is the whole package of resource inducements that are in the bill. So those sections, 300, 310, and 320, so pages 14 through 16, would not be in the bill if the administration had not recognized the changes were needed on the resource side. We also appreciate the administration identified that fiscal stability is a critical resource issue by proposing the 10-year stability provision. A troubling aspect of the resource inducement package is the tie to the exclusivity of the license project and the treble damages clause. So I'm going back again now to section 440 in the bill. Is the state not willing to provide resource term inducements to any potential project that is being advanced and to any party that underpins the pipeline construction with a firm transportation commitment? What if the chosen winner makes some promises that can't be delivered on? What happens if the license project stumbles? Is the state willing to give up their right to change tax terms and royalty terms, which is a contractual arrangement, outside of the license project without creating litigation exposure with the licensee? What if the state picks the licensee, but we know that the licensee cannot deliver on what they say? We will not have the right to get upstream stability and provisions for any other open season on a different project for up to 10 years or expose the state once again to damages. We do not want to see the project tied up in exclusive arrangements or exposed to the larger damages in order to have a backup plan. More to the specific side of the resource provisions, we remain concerned that the provisions in the bill need more work. The present bill promises to make some changes in the royalty contracts, but rather than negotiate changes to the contract, the bill would require the resource owners to accept being subject to unwritten regulations, and the regulations are subject to change every 2 years. Like I said, long-term shipping commitment, 20, 25 years, regulations changing every 2 years. The bill promises a degree of protection against potential changes to the gas production tax, which is a start. However, it does not identify the protected production tax rate, and the period of relative stability is insufficient for a project of this magnitude. In addition, there is no protection against increases in other taxes that may be aimed at circumventing the project or the protection. Now, to give an example of that, if you had production tax, gas production tax, tax stability, state corporate income tax could be increased to offset the terms that you had there. So that balance of looking at the entire tax structure is something we think that's important. We need to develop a complete resource package, and it's going to require creativity, open dialogue, and consensus. We believe that developing a resource inducement package is important. In fact, the most important aspect that will advance a project to a successful open season, but more work is needed. The next area that I want to move to is midstream requirements. My first question is, why would the state be so prescriptive in the midstream requirements? The current version of the bill has a long list of requirements that a party must demonstrate to the administration's satisfaction before their bid would be reviewed by the public and the legislature. Any bid that did not meet all of the bid requirements would be rejected out of hand, even if it brought the best all-around solutions to the challenges facing this project. For example, a bid that met every one of the requirements but said, "I cannot meet three fixed date requirements," because we felt that that might not be consistent with the best project management tools and skills that are out there, the bid would be rejected as a non-conforming bid. For approximately a year, ConocoPhillips has indicated that we have alternatives on different work commitments if the right resource framework was in place, but the prescriptive nature of the requirements would not even allow us to bring that creativity to the table. It would be rejected as a non-conforming bid. Another example of this is, what if a company decided they did not want the state capital contribution prior to the open season? For our project, we have estimated it could cost $400 to $500 million to get to the open season. The bid requirements would require us to take $200 to $250 million of state contributions to be a qualifying bid. Should we be required to take that money from the state as part of the bid?
Just a moment. Senator Wagner has a question.
Just clarification. You keep saying our requirements. Are you talking producers as a whole, or are you talking just ConocoPhillips?
Chairman, Senator Wagner through the chair. First and foremost, I'm always speaking on behalf of ConocoPhillips. I'm not speaking on behalf of a producer group or big oil. I'm here at representing ConocoPhillips. Now, with respect to the second part of that, the requirements, the midstream requirements I'm talking here are the ones that are actually laid out in the proposed AGIA bill. The list of, and I probably get the number wrong, but there's a number of requirements that are in there that you need to meet to be considered a conforming bid. And that long list of requirements is the one that I'm speaking to now, Senator Wagner. One of the few times that a pipeline really has risk in this project is prior to that open season. I guess there's a question in my mind. If you're not confident enough that you can have a successful open season and you require an inducement from the state to get through those relatively small costs, and we're talking $500 million out of a project that could be in the magnitude of $30 billion, you have to question what role you can play in the project. What about the objectives of the customers, the shippers? How do you balance the fact that many of these requirements flow through directly to the shippers? What stops a pipeline company from promising all of these terms, knowing that they can pass them on to the shippers and have the benefits of the exclusive inducements for over a decade? What happens with an empty promise? How does the state deal with someone saying they can deliver such as a particular size pipeline, and then 8 years later saying, I can't. I didn't get the firm shipping commitments. They were inadequate. Financing wasn't available, or FERC wouldn't approve the project. The current bid process encourages bidders to bid high and then beg forgiveness rather than to bid realistically. We suggest changing the current list of bid requirements to bid variables. That would be consistent with the administration's goal of a fair and transparent process, but would allow companies like ConocoPhillips, who have a lot of experience in these types of deals, to use our creativity. We understand that the state has some must-haves. Isn't it an easier way to say to the industry, we have these demands, Alaska Hire, options for gas for Alaskans, rock-solid work commitments, and others? Please bring us, industry, the most creative solutions you can to meet those demands. The final area that I wanted to move to is the mandating expansions and rolled-in rates. Why would the state want to mandate enhancements for late shippers that could threaten the viability of the basin opening project and impair state revenues? ConocoPhillips is the state's largest explorer, and I draw your attention to this slide here. And I think we can bring a different perspective to this issue. From this slide, you can see that ConocoPhillips has a strong land position. The color in orange is lands that we hold that are ConocoPhillips operated, and the ones in yellow are ConocoPhillips non-operated. We drill a number of exploration wells in Alaska every year, and we continue to explore in a region that we know is gas-prone, the NPRA. ConocoPhillips is concerned that the initial shippers who will be asked to sign up for billions and billions of dollars in firm shipping commitments that will make the pipeline project feasible are being asked to take on more risks under the proposed bill than under existing statutes and regulations. Why would a party sign up as an initial shipper if I could wait, secure in the knowledge that an expansion could be mandated and its tariff mitigated through rolled-in rate subsidies? At some point, you have to ask, are all these promises for explorers actually driving the behaviors you want? For over 4 years, I have heard companies saying they need more time prior to an open season so they can drill. We have been actively trying since 2001 to advance a gas pipeline project and get the government frameworks in place. These issues, or explorer issues, have been debated with the federal legislation, the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act, and have been debated in front of FERC with orders 2005 and 2005A. And both times, a balance was struck, and there's still no drilling. Why should I drill now when the state continues to push to provide guaranteed subsidized rates for those that defer drilling? ConocoPhillips continues to spend millions of dollars every year to advance a gas pipeline. We believe the single largest variable that will motivate new exploration on the slope is a gas pipeline and a successful open season. With costs going up the way they are, we are letting million-dollar issues drive the billion-dollar issues. Let's keep our eye on first things first. Let's compare the risks. That's the next graph here, that an initial shipper faces versus a later shipper. And I recognize this is a subjective, qualitative type analysis, and we might have debates about whether there should be 1.5x's here or 2x's here. It's more intended to be just an indication. I'd flag initial shippers, just going down here through the list, the initial shippers are going to be asked to sign up for shipping commitments potentially a decade before gas is delivered to the market, and with huge levels of uncertainty in the resulting toll they may have to pay. The cost environment for those upstream developments that the resource are facing, and the expenditures that you could be facing in trying to advance those upstream developments in parallel to the largest pipeline project in North America. Let me just highlight this issue again. We're going to be trying to get our assets ready on the upstream side, trying to get Prudhoe Bay ready for gas production, trying to develop other fields, and for us that could involve things with NPRA, in parallel to the largest private construction project in the world. Our upstream developments will be competing with the pipeline project for the very goods and services that we're going to need to have the gas ready. And that is a risk that an initial shipper is going to face in having your gas ready for the day the pipeline's ready. We do acknowledge that, you know, the gas reserves and deliverability, that's a risk that any shipper faces, whether you're an early shipper or a late shipper. The increased state takeover period of FT is also there for initial shippers versus late shippers, but the initial shippers are going to be asked to sign up for shipping commitments that could last for decades. A late shipper may not have to sign up for that duration of a shipping commitment. The increased tariffs from rolled-in rates on expansions, that's something that the initial shippers will face, and to a degree, a later shipper might face too, and I'm going to give an example of that later on here. The project delays, that usually accounts to more costs. Usually if a project's being delayed, you're spending more money and it translates to more costs. So yes, that is something a pipeline entity carries a risk while they're in the construction phase, but when the costs are finished, they will be able to pass them through to a toll to the initial shippers and to the late shippers. And then the pipeline also has a risk around obtaining those shipping commitments from creditworthy parties. That's once again, will the market support that this is the best project to do? I want to just flag, the risks are very great for the initial shippers. And we think we have to be careful that we don't set up an environment where you're in a place where everybody would say, I'd rather be a late shipper. We have to get the project out of the starting gate. The fact remains, the magnitude of these initial shipping commitments are huge. At a toll of $3.50 for a 20-year shipping commitment, that initial shipping commitment could be in excess of $26 billion for a 1 BCF a day commitment. Now multiply that number times 4 to get to a 4 BCF a day pipeline. It's about $100 billion worth of shipping commitments that will sit behind this project when it goes into construction, or when it has an open season. That value is several times the value of many of the companies that might apply under this process. I ask myself, who has the financial strength to sit behind those types of numbers if natural gas prices plummet for a period of time, or if a field has deliverability problems? I also want to emphasize that I'm surprised that access is being raised as a question. I'm actually not aware that access has been a problem for anyone to date on the North Slope. Anadarko is our partner, and Alpine has access to facilities to produce their oil in NPRA. They have access to taps. We know their spare capacity in taps. And we have demonstrated a willingness to work facilities access with parties like Pioneer. With respect to the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline, the U.S. Congress already created an unprecedented provision with the mandated expansion provisions to ensure access to this pipeline. I'd emphasize there's no similar provision on any other pipeline in the lower 48 than the mandated expansion that was passed with Section 105 of the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act. If a shipper is willing to sign up for firm shipping commitments, which translates to pay for the expansion, and can demonstrate that that expansion won't require others to subsidize it, the FERC can order an expansion of the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline. In addition, there's absolutely no issue with a party making a firm shipping commitment on the gas pipeline project, even if you haven't found gas. You just need to be prepared to pay the toll. isn't the real issue here not access, but the cost of that access? I understand why the state wants to create enhancements for exploration, and as an explorer, I'm happy about that. We want to see new gas volumes. We want co-venturers to explore within Alaska's North Slope, and I think I've communicated this before, but it's pretty risky drilling exploration wells at 100% dollars. We like to have partners to explore and help spread our risks. We are the state's largest explorer, and we can see both sides of the equation on many of these issues regarding expansions and rolled-in rates. To be clear, ConocoPhillips does not oppose the application of rolled-in rates for some expansions, but we do have some concerns with mandating that application for all potential expansions. We are not opposing the language in FERC Order 2005 and in 2005A that grants the presumption of rolled-in rates. I'm going to read from that Order 2005. In conclusion, to provide guidance to potential shippers in advance of the initial open season that is subject to this rule, the Commission intends to harmonize both objectives, rate predictability for the initial shippers and reductions of barriers to future exploration and production, in designing rates for future expansions of any Alaska natural gas transportation project. It is consistent with our guiding principle that competition favors all of the Commission's customers, as well as with the objectives of the Act to adopt rolled-in treatment up to the point that would cause there to be a subsidy of expansion shippers by initial shippers, if any subsidy were to be found. And that's on page 44 and 18 CFR Part 157, Order Number 2005, which was February 9th, 2005. Let me illustrate a few concerns with the approach we have of mandating rolled-in rates for all expansions and mandating expansions that may be commercially unreasonable. Some of the exploration volumes could be from federal or private lands, and some may even be from lands that the state can't tax. Drawing your attention to this graph here that was in your pack. This is here just to kind of illustrate. We tend to focus a lot of our attention right here on this little circle in blue here where the existing infrastructure is. But in reality, these exploration volumes we're talking about are likely going to be in the Chukchi, the Beaufort, NPRA, Anwar, and the foothills. So we tend to focus in on a small area, and the exploration volumes are going to be out in these different regions. If you skip then to the next slide that I've got in your pack, these are from publicly available sources from different United States Geological Survey assessments, and I've put the dates down as to when the different assessments were made. But I'd like to draw your attention to the three biggest numbers on here. The largest potential areas, 83 TCF in NPRA, 72 TCF in the Beaufort, 210 TCF in the Chukchi. And I'll flag, I've worked on these. These are unrisked, technically, I think, recoverable type numbers. But those three biggest numbers are in areas where the state has no royalty or some of these, not even production taxes from. Let me explain an example of where I think, from the state's perspective, you might question whether or not mandating rolled-in rates would work. Prudhoe Bay has a toll, for example, of $4. And there's an expansion that comes along that says the toll would go up to $4.60, the 15% increase. The state would receive less royalty and production taxes, less permanent fund contributions from Prudhoe Bay by the fact that the toll is going up. Now, many people have argued saying there could be statewide inducements or benefits from that other exploration volume coming in here. But what if that exploration volume was from a field in the Beaufort where the state has no royalty or no production taxes from it? So you would be in a place where you're receiving less royalty and less production taxes from Prudhoe Bay, but no new revenue coming in from that field coming in from the Beaufort. And I do acknowledge there's going to be some socioeconomic benefits of having developments going on in the Beaufort, but you will not be getting a revenue stream directly from those developments. Another example of mandated rolled-in rates, which could be problematic, is an NPRA example. What if we are successful in NPRA after initial open season and we think we've got a good expansion, 800 million a day, cubic feet a day kind of expansion? And I'm actually just grabbing numbers for illustrative purposes. I'm not actually calculating them. The toll, once again, let's just say the toll was $4. If that toll, due to this 800 million a day expansion, through the application of rolled-in rates, was a good expansion, you might see the toll go down for everybody to 380. And that explorer that was making the development decision to produce or develop that field said, toll's $3.80, it looks like I should go ahead with this development. But 5 years later, there's another expansion where the toll would go up to $5 because it's an expansion from the Beaufort. You made your investment decision thinking that you had a $3.80 toll, and all of a sudden now you're facing a $5 toll. That's the type of uncertainty that even as an explorer or a late shipper, you might be exposed to by mandating rolled-in rates. Another example would be, for example, if there is some short haul and short haul service to Fairbanks, for example. And I said short haul means that you just said, I want to take capacity out in an open season just to ship my gas from the North Slope to Fairbanks. And let's just assume that that toll is 50 cents to go from the North Slope to Fairbanks. If there was an expansion, they could be exposed to the toll going up from 50 cents to 57.5 cents. And all of a sudden, consumers in Fairbanks are going, why am I having to pay more to transport the gas when there's an expansion coming in from somewhere else that's not delivering any more volumes here? So there's both on the customer end, as well as on the shipper end, scenarios where mandating rolled-in rates may not be in the best interest of all the parties involved. All we are suggesting is let the FERC be the adjudicator on this issue. ConocoPhillips might very well be the company in there arguing for the application of rolled-in rates, and the state might want to be on the opposite side, or vice versa. Our perspective is we just don't know what the expansions might look like, where they might come from. FERC has a rebuttable presumption of rolled-in rates that's not being challenged. What we'd say is just let the FERC adjudicate those issues, and all of us have the flexibility then to argue our case for whether we think a subsidy's been made at that point in time in the future. I'd also highlight that there are many tools in the state's toolbox to deal with the issue of enhancing exploration and motivating expansions, including things like royalty reductions and tax credits. The state could put a capital contribution in on an expansion at some point in the future. There's many tools in the state's toolbox to incent that exploration. What is inappropriate, though, is to require the initial shippers, the ones who have already taken exploration risk, to find the existing known resource, and who will be taking on the multi-billion dollar risk that will make this pipeline possible, to subsidize those that have not yet taken those risks. We can't let unknown gas prospects that could take a decade to explore, appraise, and develop drive the timing and development of the approximately 35 TCF of known resources and the largest private construction project in North America. I'll conclude my remarks today by summarizing what I think are the key issues. ConocoPhillips is ready to solve issues with the Alaska Legislature and the Governor. We want to actively work with you to achieve a framework that promotes the development of the ANS gas resources and addresses the legitimate interests of all parties. The key to advancing the gas pipeline is really to address the resource issues and providing adequate security to companies so that they can make the long-term shipping commitments is the critical issue that will result in a project. We urge you to not lose sight of this fundamental issue. The project is so difficult that we have to be on the same team, and we have to recognize that compromise, like in all major decisions in life, is necessary for all parties. We have to have focus on doing what it takes to get this project moving forward. We can't lose sight that costs are going up on the project. The recent announcement on the Mackenzie Delta project costs increasing confirms this and should make us all step back and pause for a second. We need to remember the real prize, the tens of billions of dollars in new tax and royalty revenues, the countless jobs, the new economy that will be created with a new gas exploration and development industry for decades to come. To achieve this prize, the risk must be realistically addressed, and risk and rewards must be balanced. We've had 30 years of an oil economy. We need to look forward to a new gas economy. We need to find a creative way to make it happen. No company will work harder than ConocoPhillips to make this project a reality. I'd be happy to try to answer any of your questions.
Yes, Senator Wagner.
I'd like to request from Ms. King to get a copy of your testimony today before you leave so I can go through it again and absorb a little more of it. I'm kind of on overload right now.
Senator Wagner, through the chair, I actually don't work off written testimony. I work off bullets, and I've got some hand-scribbled notes here. But what I would be very happy to do with any of you in the committee is come by and have individual conversations, walk through the points again. Specifically, I know some of the examples. It's hard with a lot of numbers. I would be very happy to try to sit down and go through the materials in more detail, but I don't have a final prepared testimony
that's all right.
That I can share.
I can have a transcript. Okay. I just thought it would save some time.
other questions for Wendy?
Just.
Senator Wagner.
I'm going to go in reverse order. I got one. When you were talking about exploration risk and in relation to rolled-in rates and the penalties, and I understand that ConocoPhillips is an explorer. You're up there working hard in the MPRA and some other areas. Some of the other people we've heard from aren't exploring as much as you are. And some of the new explorers are going to start exploring. So I guess the problem I'm having when we start talking about those type of penalties, and I can see where you might think they're a penalty, is two out of three of the people up there really aren't exploring that much for gas to increase the supply of gas. And basically, two biggest supplies of gas have already been explored for, and we already know where they're at. So, I'm just having a problem with your statement as far as the exploration risk, because there's not a lot of risk in some cases. You guys in the MPRA are taking risk, but a lot of the other risk has already been taken, and the gas has proven up.
Senator Wagner, through the chair. Maybe what would help is to illustrate a risk that I see, and I'm going to go back from my personal experiences. I worked in the United Kingdom for a while in a region called the Southern Gas Basin, and we had a known resource in the Southern Gas Basin, and it was producing very well. And one particularly cold winter, we had a very unexpected event happen in the reservoir, and we were unable to produce gas from that field for an entire winter. It was a fun project to be working on that winter, if I can imagine. But let me highlight that those types of things happen. And when you have taken on the magnitude of a shipping commitment risk from a pipe or project or an asset the size of Prudhoe Bay, if something went wrong, that is a huge risk associated with it. And so I would not just assume because the resource is found that we have all the answers and there's not going to be risk associated with production and deliverability, even from the known resource. So that's one comparison that I would make. The other point I can't articulate on other companies' exploration strategies, but what I do believe is that the federal government is going to be paying very close attention. The FERC will be paying very close attention to ensure that access is provided to those that have volumes in the state. And as an explorer, and I've had people say, well, you're an explorer producer, but you want to take an ownership position in the pipe, so you know it's all money going from one to the other. Well, I would argue, or at least point out to people, that when we say we want to align our ownership interest in the pipe with our shipping commitment, that's based on the initial volumes. If we have exploration volumes, we very well might not be aligned on those issues. And so, once again, we could find ourselves in a different situation as an explorer. We still believe the best alternative is to be able to lay out the facts at the time that the expansion's being advanced. Was a party willing to sign up for shipping commitments? Is it going to result in a subsidy? And let the FERC see the facts at that time and be the adjudicator. And we know that if we're the ones that believe that a subsidy's happening, the FERC's starting with a rebuttable presumption of rolled-in rates. So you've got a little bit of a hurdle to get over to show that there's a subsidy. But we believe that that's the best venue to be able to deal with the specific facts at that point in time. And then I'd once again go back to the point of you as a state have many vehicles at that point in the future to enhance that exploration. If a discovery is made and it's struggling economically, there are many tools in your toolbox that you can use with specific facts then, knowing where that field is coming from, knowing what its impact will be on the pipeline project as a whole, you can weigh the balance of that and say what inducement is appropriate at that point in time in the future to get that exploration volume into the markets in the lower 48.
Yeah, Wendy, thank you in that respect. You know, the system as it's existing right now is essentially administration has laid out AGIA. You're coming, we're talking about AGIA. In my mind, a important component is your ability to communicate directly to the people that built AGIA, that designed it, understands it better than most, and has some intent in AGIA. Have you had that opportunity?
Chairman Huggins, we met with the administration two times in January, and there have been a couple of informal meetings, but we have not had a lot of formal dialogue to date with the administration. That being said, I'm confident that Commissioner Irwin, Commissioner Galvin, they've said they would like to talk with ConocoPhillips, so I'm sure that there's an opportunity there to continue dialogue. But to date, there have been limited meetings.
Yeah, one of the things that I've come to conclusion on is that it is important that for this project to be able to be successful, that a facilitation, a synchronization of players is mandatory, so that in open season we have some reasonable expectation of success and not let the chips fall as they may, based on some rewrite of a bill. Correct me if I'm wrong in that perception.
Chairman Huggins, I can only, and I, you know, only point back. These are complex issues. It is very difficult. I find it difficult to be able to communicate effectively, even in this forum, the complexity of some of these issues. And that's why I wanted to use a few slides today, but I still understand these are hard, complex issues. It does require time to just sit in a room and talk about the issues and roll up your sleeves. I think it's critical that you have that ability. It took 2 years, 3 years, the time before, just to get up to speed with the issues and the complexity of the issues from both sides. And so it does take time, and it takes hammering things around a table to be able to actually make progress. So I would agree that there is a lot of dialogue that's going to be needed to work through these issues.
Yeah, and said another way, I mean, it's a technique. I question the outcome of we take a bill, you tell us the problems with the bill, we try to capture that, modify the bill, and return it back to the system. That's a technique, but it's a cumbersome technique. Too many middle ground parties and perceptions, and the people that are implementing are not the ones that people that are potentially making the changes. I would ask you to expand. You made a statement earlier. The single issue of success is a successful pipeline / open season. Would you say a few more words about that?
Chairman Huggins, the critical milestone that I see for this project is that open season. That's when a pipeline entity comes forward and says, here's the services that we think we can provide, here's the costs we think we can provide them at. And at that point in time, each potential customer is going to go back, each potential shipper is going to go back and say, with what I know now, and there's still some questions that need to be addressed as potential shippers. I'd flag as, you know, working interest owner in Prudhoe Bay, we are still working with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission to find out what is the appropriate offtake rate for gas out of Prudhoe Bay. And I've had a lot of people ask questions about Prudhoe Bay is a complex, it's a excellent field, but it's a complex field, and that when you start, that gas has been working hard for decades to produce more and more oil out of that field. When you start taking that gas off, there will be impacts in the reservoir of doing that. That's one issue that the working interest owners in Prudhoe Bay will need to work through with the AOGCC to be ready for that open season. That's just one of the many issues that will need to be ready for that open season. But when that open season happens, that's when the customers are going to have to say, look, I've weighed the risks. This is what I think the market's going to be doing. These are what I think I can deliver from my assets. This is what I think the eventual costs will be on the project and how they'll get translated back to me. And that will be a signal of when my customer is willing to say, I'm willing to sign up for a 20 to 25 year shipping commitment, that the markets are supporting, that this project is ready to go forward. Still doesn't mean that the project is guaranteed, because there still could be opportunities where the costs increase dramatically after you get going, but it indicates the market's ready to try to move the project forward. And so it is a critical milestone.
Other question, Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thank you for the courtesy of allowing me to sit up here and ask some questions. Ms. King, I'm going to ask you two questions that I asked Mr. Massey as well. First of all, if regardless of who the licensee is, if the bill passed and Conoco wanted to come to an open season and ship a billion cubic feet a day or whatever, and your partners, BP and Exxon, chose not to, or just BP came, or just Exxon came, or however it worked out, is that possible to do under the operating agreement or the unit agreement, or do you all have to swim together?
Representative Samuels, through the chair. That question is actually a complex question that's going to have to be handled on a case-by-case basis, depending upon the specific circumstances at that time. We do have long-term agreements with our fellow working interest owners, and we have to, you know, there's, like I mentioned, there's some real complex issues here. There's the impacts on oil. If one party starts to take gas off, it's going to have an impact. And so another one is impurities. We all have discussed that Prudhoe Bay has 12% CO2. What happens if one party wants to start putting more CO2 back into the ground? So it's a complex question. I know there have been frustration about, can't you provide a clear answer on this? But I'd highlight, it is just going to have to be a case-by-case situation. We will have to assess what the other producer wants to do, what we need to do. We're going to have to assess what the governing agreements actually say. And we're going to have to assess whether or not the impact on the working interest owners and the arrangements are what would be necessary to accommodate what each party's reasonable concerns are. So it's not a clear answer, and it would require a lot of review on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you. And the other question, you mentioned the work commitments, and I think that the frustration that came with the drafters of AGEA came on the exclusivity was that if you didn't have the exclusivity, then nobody would play because you have the gas and you automatically have a leg up on everybody, and it's kind of common sense. You mentioned that there were other ideas for the work commitment idea. I know that at this very table last year, we discussed, instead of using state money, we were going to use your money. And I know that Conoco, if I remember correctly, agreed. The state, Conoco, BP, and Exxon, if they would all pony up $300 million each during the last go-around to get to the open season, and if you didn't reach a certain number of gates at a certain timeline, that the state was going to penalize you, were going to keep some of the money. I don't remember exactly how it worked, but generally that's how it was framed, that there was going to be some penalty for work commitments. So do you have any other thoughts on work commitments? You realize the exclusivity, and I understand the pros and cons of the exclusivity, but do you realize why it's in there? Do you have any other ideas on what Conoco's view would be, so that you forward the idea that something actually happens and we move the project forward without having to pick the winner before the race starts?
Representative Samuels, through the chair. Yes, actually a year ago, I remember, and actually it wasn't even quite a year ago, maybe it was in July or August in this very room.
Yesterday.
In this very room, I remember highlighting that ConocoPhillips does believe that there is more that could be done from our perspective on work commitments. And in particular, we discussed the idea of, you know, hard dates make us nervous. We have been, not because we don't want to go forward with the project, we just believe we need, with the largest private construction project in North America, we get concerned about being sticking to a date and ending up spending costs and having a cost blowout on the other end because you were driven by a date. But we do believe that there are things that could be done from our perspective on dollars to show commitment to the project. But the critical issue for me on that is still having the frameworks in place. Still addressing those resource issues become a critical priority before work commitments from that perspective. But I would add, that's why I think moving the bid requirements to bid variables would allow us the flexibility to go back and bring some sharp minds together and say, what creative solution? The state wants to see something rock solid to know there's a commitment to this project, to advance it forward. There's creativity that could be out there, and that's just one idea. There might be other alternatives that could come out there in the future. So I do believe that there's some creativity we could bring to the table there.
Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Let me just say, I really appreciate your testimony. I thought you brought up a lot of good points, which, and I'd like to get a copy, or if possible, of as much of what you said as well, because it did bring up a lot of good points, I thought.
Yeah, let me add in there, I'm sorry I didn't mention, that our our very efficient staff will have the testimony available in written form on Monday afternoon at our next meeting.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question I do have is on the operating agreement as well. Is there a provision in the Prudhoe operating agreement, to your knowledge, that says if one producer takes a certain amount of gas, then all the other producers have to take their gas?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, you have me. I have not read the Prudhoe Bay operating agreement. And I will confess I am also not a lawyer, even though I have been cautioned that I've talked like one at times. I am not a lawyer, and I cannot. I have not seen a provision. I'm not aware of a provision, but that does not mean it does not exist. I would just flag again that the issues around that, I think, still stand. It's a case by case. We're going to have to look at the specific circumstances at that point in time and see what alternatives might be out there.
Yes, Senator Wagner.
I'm sorry, it's kind of an unfair question. I'm going to ask. And from what I interpret from your testimony and some of the things you pointed out, I'm like my colleague here, I think you pointed out some very good things to look at. But if there isn't modifications to AGEA, are you basically saying that you don't believe ConocoPhillips will be participating in open season in that case due to the risk here?
Senator Wagner, through the chair, it would once again, I'm not going to say what will happen at some point in the future. I don't know what the situation might be at that point. No, we won't know what the costs of the project are. We won't know what the natural gas price markets are. What I have flagged is that there are four key areas in AGEA right now that we think we need to roll up our sleeves on and focus in on those. And that's our first and foremost priority right now, is focusing on those key four areas and work with you and the administration to try to get a gas pipeline project moving forward.
Senator Wagner?
But isn't it true it doesn't matter who offers the first open season? When you go to that open season to commit gas, no matter who's going to build that line, you still don't know what the total price of that project is going to be.
Senator Wagner, through the chair, that is correct. That is correct. You will not know the actual cost of this project until it is completed. And let me just add a component on this. You know, we have got experts in our company, and we have got experts in a lot of different companies, but I would just flag, we have learned that a little good, what we call front-end engineering design in the upfront part of a project will save you billions of dollars on the backside. And that's an important aspect of skills that I think we as a company can bring to the table in the construction of one of the largest private construction projects in North America, is bringing those types of skills to say, you know, we need to take a pause here, because if we spend a little bit more money right now, we spend $10 million right now studying this issue, it could save us billions of dollars later. And those important aspects are something we think we can bring to the table as a participator in a pipeline project going forward.
Senator Wagner, follow up.
Well, one other question. In your testimony, you mentioned facility sharing agreements, and you're with Pioneer. You haven't completed a facility sharing agreement yet, have you?
Senator Wagner, through the chair, I do not know the answer to that question. I apologize. I know we are working on it, but I do not know the status of it. I can get back to you on that.
I just wanted to point out it's easy to talk about it, but it's a very difficult process to go through and get access for some of the smaller operators on the slopes to get access to facilities. And I know there's very good reasons why, as far as capacity and everything. So, yeah, I'd like to know that.
Senator Wagner, the chair, I will follow up on the status of those.
I think maybe we have someone in the audience that may potentially have the answer to that. Is that true?
If somebody could help me out, that would be
okay.
Great.
Can I call
a lifeline?
Disregard what
please?
I said. If you'll find that answer for us, we'd appreciate
yes,
it.
Yes, happy to do that.
And Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. King, you mentioned that it could be $400 million for an open season, and I believe the administration testified it was between $50 and $200,
yeah.
Which put the states on the 50-50 is $25 to $100 million. You're going double that. Is there that much of a discrepancy in an open season? And the second part of the question is, how fast could you get to if you are queen for a day, and Conoco was going to come, and Exxon and BP are going to come to an open season, how long would it take you to get to an open season and to do the work, the diligence that you would require so that you knew what you're told, a rough estimate of what you're told would be? How long would it take, and then why the discrepancy in the doubling of the money?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, there's actually a few points I'll draw on that. Our estimate in 2001-2002 was that it would take approximately $400 to $500 million to get complete an open season. In our success case timeline, and I'd flag it's our success case timeline, the one that was public in May, that one indicated it would be roughly 18 months before you would start an open season. Then there's a FERC requirement. The FERC's really going to require almost a six-month window to do the open season. They've got 90 days to approve your open season plans and then 90 days to hold the open season. So we said in our success case schedule that we could complete an open season in 2 years from when you actually start, you know, getting people ready to get out into the field, get your environmental field data you're going to need to have ready for when your open season's done, and get all the commercial work done. My reading of the proposed AGEA, though, does not say that an open season, there's certain requirements you need to do prior to an open season. The way I would read the proposed bill is that you could actually hold an open season even after spending $10 million and then be in the state matching section of 80% dollars after that. There's no clear threshold that one open season has to be like another open season, and that different people might do different pieces of work prior to an open season. Our schedule was we wanted to have the four seasons of environmental field data that we need to get. We wanted to be doing that in parallel to the commercial work of getting an open season, so when the open season was completed, we would be ready to submit our applications to the FERC and to the NEB. So we had some parallel activities. But it's not to say that all project sponsors would necessarily hold an open season at the same time frame. So that could be why you're seeing some of the discrepancy in the numbers. But I will reiterate, it was the $400 to $500 million was the work that we had done previously to complete an open season in roughly 2 years from when you start on a success-based schedule.
Okay. Follow up on that, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
So you just said you could do more of a haphazard one, you can do it, a cheaper one. But if you spent the $400 million, then how much would you spend then getting into the certificate? If you could do it in 2 years, how much more, if you said you're, I thought I heard you say that you would be far more ready then to get the certificate. How much more, how much total money do you think you'll spend to get to the certificate?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, the cost estimate in 2001, and I'm sensitive here, I can tell I'm going to have some people in different places saying, Lear, keep quoting these 2001 figures, please stop. But the 2001 figures, and so I believe these numbers will be going up, and I want to reiterate a point that I heard yesterday. It is going to take some strong engineering, environmental regulatory work to do a updated cost estimate for this project. It cost us $125 million the first time to come up with our cost estimate. It's not a simple undertaking to update the cost estimate. Now, just to go back, I think I lost my train of thought there. That estimate at that time was, it was roughly $400 to $500 million to get to to complete an open season, and another $500, we thought about $1 billion in 2001, to get to your FERC certificate, which would be on a success-based schedule 4 years away. Then you made your construction decision, and that's when you started to spend the $19-plus billion associated with the pre-construction and construction phase. So that was the general breakdown back in 2001 dollars. $400 to $500, and then up to $1 billion cumulative, an additional $500 to $600 million in that 2 years of permitting.
So if you didn't spend, I'm going back to the, if somebody could do the open season for $50 million, you just have less information for the shippers to know? I mean, it's a pretty big discrepancy, 50 to 400. I mean, tenfold the money for one group as opposed to what some of the estimates were. You just have less information, so you trust the tariff that they throw out there a little bit less, or?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, I'm not sure that you would trust the estimate. Yeah, you know, I mean, that would be a key question. If somebody held an open season very soon, what would be the cost estimate that they were basing that on? Is it a cost estimate that you would believe is a good cost estimate? But there's, you know, other than the clear FERC requirement of 6 months, It's more, how do you think the best way to manage the project is? What activities do you want to do in parallel? But I don't see anything in the bill that would foreclose somebody holding an open season sooner than the time frame that we had. It's just we felt that was the best way to manage the project.
Okay, so if you use the example of Rocky Mountains Express, I don't know if you know particular ones, but a relatively big project that you're part of, mm-hmm. is it half the money that you'd spend getting the open season there and then the other half to the certificate?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, I believe, and I don't have those figures at the top of my head, but I do believe some colleagues of mine pointed out to me that the rough percentage that we were thinking was consistent with some of the other major pipeline projects that we'd seen. So the percentage that we applied to what it would cost to get to an open season appears to be consistent with some of the other projects that we've seen. And I can follow up on that a little bit more, because most of that information on some of those pipelines is public information.
I'll have an opportunity to chat with you again next
week. I think on Wednesday I have an opportunity to get that follow-up question.
Thank you.
Clarified.
Yeah, thank you, Wendy. I'm going to ask you to go to page 11, and let's talk about exclusivity. And if you look between lines 14 and 25, and let me just, I'll characterize how it was described to me once upon a time by a person I respect and is very thoughtful and is very passionate about this issue. That if you look at this, the scenario we, the state, have found ourselves in is we're now managing failure. And it's just a matter of whether we're falling off the edge and have disaster. In the sense that this in the provision of AGEA, in the accordion of timeline, has a provision just to extend the project for kickoff by 5 years. And if you take the numbers that were given to us by the administration, if gas was $750 in 5 years, that would be about $12 billion, maybe $13 billion that would cost the state. That's, I'm just looking at the, and extrapolating. But be that as it may, would you give me ConocoPhillips' take on that provision?
Chairman Huggins, this section here of 210 B and C, my read on it is pretty clear. If you've had a successful open season and you've got your FERC certificate and you've got credit support, you have to commit. Let me just flag an A first. You have to accept the FERC application, which FERC has the right to put conditions on a certificate. So this would be requiring somebody to accept that FERC certificate in A. B then says once you've accepted that FERC certificate that you have 1 year to go forward to project sanction. And if you don't have credit support, you still have the exclusive inducements in this chapter for another 5 years, or another 4 years, I guess, depending on you're counting on the 1 year. You still have the exclusive inducements under this chapter all the way through that time, even if you haven't had credit support. Now, one question that we are still evaluating is normally, I believe, and I apologize, I did not have time to listen to the FERC's testimony this week, but my understanding is that normally FERC would say you have 1 to 2 years after you receive a certificate by which you need to go forward with construction, and it's predominantly because the environmental data that you've based your environmental analysis on, your environmental impacts, will start to get stale if you sit on a certificate for too long. So I don't actually know how the FERC answered those questions if they were asked in the other hearing. But what I would flag is that it seems unusual to provide such an extended period of time after a FERC certificate if the market isn't supported it. So you've gone through a period where potentially you could have had 4 or 5 years just to get to the FERC certificate, and another 4 or 5 years on top of that. And so that's where I came up to the estimate of 10 years that you could have the exclusive rights under Section 440.
Right. I the way you described it is sort of congruent with my thought process, I think, in that if we then retrospectively look back to where we are today, some of the things that some people are suggesting might appear to be inexpensive in comparison, because, I mean, if let's just put us in that five-year scenario to kick off, that the licensee is going to look right to the Senate president or the majority leader of the House and say, I need money. Mm-hmm. I'm stalling. I'm bankrupt. Whatever it is. And I need to be able to, if I'm going to continue for the next 5 years, I need help. And they're not going to go down to Alaska Housing Finance to get help. they're going to look to the state of Alaska specifically. But if you disagree with that, please tell me.
No, Chairman Huggins. I think that there is some exposure that parties could be coming back at that time and questioning how do they go forward. And you will have invested a substantial amount of time and money at that point, and I understand the analysis of delays.
Yes. And I just to beat that dead horse one more time, is that the term I think is most commonly used in this building is we would be leveraged to an extreme degree if we wanted to continue on with that licensee. Is that a term that you're familiar with that might apply?
I've heard the term leverage a couple times, Chairman Huggins.
Okay, thank you very much. Other questions for Ms. King? Wendy, as usual, you're very articulate, but more important, what you gave to us, and I think it's characterized plainly by a couple of members and the rest of us agreeing that we want to read your transcript because, I mean, you pointed out some things, quite frankly, that maybe is not new news, but the way you articulated them gave us fertilizer for thought and things that we need to think about because this is important to the destiny of our state in the future. And I know that ConocoPhillips and yourself articulating that wants to be a partner in success, and we want you to be a part of that in the partnership. We just got to figure out how to make that work and facilitate a relationship between the state and all the working groups in that. So on behalf of Alaska and the legislature, I say thank you very much and say thanks to Representative Samuels, the Majority Leader of the House, for being
thanks
with us.
For having me.
And with that, we are adjourned.